Yesterday was a big birthday in northern Arizona. Grand Canyon National Park turned 100. I mean, yes, the canyon itself is something like 12 million years old, but its status as a national park dates back to an act of Congress signed on February 26, 1919. We can celebrate, but we can also take note of the general shape of federal lands of all types: parks, forests, rangeland, the whole ball of wax. Stephen Nash observes a number of challenges in his book, Grand Canyon for Sale: Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Stephen Nash has reported on science and the environment for years, with work appearing in the Washington Post and other major publications. He is also the author of two previous books and is visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond. Stephen Nash, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So the science advisor of the Park Service director has a very interesting quote up early in the book. Our mission is to preserve things in perpetuity, and we do it on an annual budget and a four-year presidential cycle. So that sort of gives us an idea of how much the long view is impacted by short-term needs.
It certainly does. Yeah, he had a nice sense of irony and of the predicament of the Park Service generally, and all of us by extension.
So as you look at this, I mean, what you've done here is essentially taken a whole issue of public lands at many different levels and sort of focused them through the lens of the Grand Canyon, which is certainly one of the more visible places. But it's a compelling case, I mean, because you give us features within the canyon and things that are going on there and relate them to the rest of the world. Is it a pretty good test case, you think?
I think it is, not only for the whole national park system, but all of those public lands that you listed a moment ago, including the Rogue Siskiyou National Forest. You know, I grew up in, I think, the best part of my youth in Cave Junction and Kirby, and if I had stuck around there, I could give a shout-out to all the friends I would have had there in Josephine County. And around Ashland, too. So it's nice to be back on the radio there. It brings that wonderful few years that I spent there to mind. My stepdad was a logger when we lived around there, and so I got a pretty close-up view way back then of clear cuts and some of the other forest management issues, although when I was a kid I didn't see them that way. Grand Canyon is a test case because in the future, we're going to need, in order to preserve the biology of places like Grand Canyon, we're going to need to consolidate and protect all those public lands and elevate them to a status where natural systems are prioritized instead of short-term returns and industrializing those landscapes.
Does that mean things like treating national forests more like national parks?
It does. It sounds like a radical notion, but it is logical notion, I think, given the pressures that climate change is exerting on all natural systems everywhere, including in North America. As things heat up, whether it gets rainier where you are or gets drier or is just unpredictable, which is true over some large parts of the continent, whatever happens with that, it's going to get warmer and very quickly. That means the plants and the animals and the insect life, the whole ecosystem in each of these places is going to be needing to move to higher elevations or more northerly latitudes to stay within the climate envelope that they've all evolved to survive within. And for that to happen, they can't move across farmlands and freeways and commercial retail space and housing developments. We've got a wonderful opportunity in our public lands. They're a huge, beautiful portfolio of opportunity to adapt to climate change.
We'll talk about the corridors in just a bit because those are indeed mentioned in the book. But I want to talk about the political stuff for just a moment because you mentioned early in the book about the House voting not terribly long ago in history to value federal lands as worthless. And then, of course, just yesterday we had the vote on the Natural Resources Management Act, which was overwhelmingly in favor, which sends that to the president's desk, and apparently he'll sign it.
Yes, I'm glad to know that. You're ahead of my curve. I hadn't known that was being disposed of. Good.
So, but that gives an indication of how quickly the political winds can change where public lands are concerned. What was that earlier point that you make in the book about the House voting to value federal lands as not having value?
Well, you can hear me preaching like a street corner evangelist here, and and believe me, this idea is not original to me, about connecting and protecting public lands and prioritizing natural systems on public lands rather than all of those short-term benefits. But the real momentum is in the opposite direction. I'm glad for the movement on that bill that you mentioned. That is one point in a general picture in which tens of millions of dollars and a whole lot of political clout are lined up in favor of breaking up our public lands and either giving them back to the states to administer or, in many cases, advocating selling them off to private interests exclusively. Even within the current system of federal lands, what we do is lease the right to mine or drill or log or graze those lands to such an extent that they are and have been for a long time under considerable threat. So instead of consolidating them, the move is to bust them up and sell them off.
Well, so you say that the question of why the United States owns so much land, you say the most compelling answer to that question is outside both history and politics, and I'll give you a chance to mull that one over because we need to take a break right here, and I want to give you a chance for a more detailed answer. The book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. It's the work of Stephen Nash, who's been reporting on science and the environment for a very long time. We'll come back and talk more with Stephen, and this is a conversation that might fire you up enough to want to get to the phone or the email box to let us know what you're thinking as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Nash and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about public lands today. Yesterday was the 100th birthday of the foundation of Grand Canyon as a national park through the signature of President Wilson back in 1919. Stephen Nash, we observed the date with him with his book, Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. And when we look at public lands coming up against dollars and coming up against political winds and many more forces at a time in history when climate change is indicating different needs for lands. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the discussion by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. And back to your statement in the book, Stephen, where you say the most compelling answer to the question, why does the United States own so much land, is outside both history and politics. What do you mean?
What beautiful language. Let me see if I can retrieve what I had in mind when I wrote that. what I was really referring to is that it is difficult to take the whole administrative momentum and the whole change in national consciousness into a few sentences or even a few pages and explain why a third of the landscape within the United States, it's a million square miles, is in public hands, not just in public hands, but in public hands under the purview of our national administration. It's just a very complicated kind of situation, not quite cosmic in scale, but there aren't many other countries that have managed to preserve this legacy over this amount of time without succumbing to the urge to privatize it or commandeer it in some other way for short-term benefit. A hundred or so years ago, in the Teddy Roosevelt era and before, we began to develop something like a wilderness consciousness. And it's not that all public land is wilderness, far from it. But that was one of the substrata behind the idea that, look, maybe we don't need to use all of this land for short-term needs and to parcel it out to private individuals. Maybe in our national interest, there's a strong interest in keeping it intact and keeping it for the future.
Well, which raises the question that it seems like nobody says it quite this way, but you get the idea from watching the way people respond to public land. and certainly it's strengthened by reading your book. The idea that land has no value if no one is doing anything with it.
Yes, it's really an understandable kind of human proclivity that if there's what looks like empty space, how nice it would be to fill it up with what looks like a useful kind of project. The problem is that underneath that is a sort of a lack of understanding that the land is being used for things that are absolutely essential to our well-being. I'll give you an example that applies to the national forests, including the lovely green expanse of national forests there in the Northwest. 20% of our national supply of clean water, that's water available for drinking and for irrigating and other uses, 20% of it comes from our national forest lands. Those trees on what looks like otherwise empty land are not just lumber, and they're not just taking up space. They're holding soil against wind and water and other kinds of erosion. They're providing a whole lot of ecosystem services that matter a great deal for us. But beyond that, there is a sense that obliterating all natural life, sterilizing huge amounts of landscape and replacing them with concrete and asphalt and human constructions, which are glorious in their own right, but maybe they are not always the highest and best use for the landscape. And currently, again, we have this opportunity of protecting those lands. We've still got a lot of them left. They're not always in great shape, but often we can remediate those conditions. And they're a buffer. And this is the biggest, the largest, and most intense scale of use I can think of. They're a buffer against what climate change is going to be doing.
All right, so a hedge against the future activity from the climate and what happens as the Earth warms up. The history you give here is fascinating when you point out different times and different objectives within federal agencies in charge of managing land. And you take us to the Forest Service, the Park Service rather, in Mission 66. What was that?
Mission 66 was a post-war initiative in the National Park Service. Which had, in part, very good motivations. The human infrastructure in the national parks, the access roads and the buildings and the safety fences and guardrails, what was there in the national parks had been neglected almost since their creation, and certainly with the onset of World War II and other kinds of preoccupations. Mission 66 was meant to prop all of that back up, to refurbish it. But the downside of that initiative was the feeling that the national parks would be best used if we could maximize the amount of throughput, the number of tourists that were processed. No thought was given at times to what that would mean for the natural systems of the parks. It's the same old contradiction that you can't lay asphalt over a natural landscape and figure that that isn't going to have some impact on the plants and animals. Mission 66 was rather quickly pushed more to the margins, although a whole lot happened to the parks during that era in terms of construction and some outright damage. That whole initiative began to grind to a halt the more we began to hear about the peril that the national parks were in, and the more our national environmental consciousness began to evolve in the middle 1970s. It isn't that tourism disappeared from national parks, but this urge to build things within the boundaries of national parks, that began to show a lot more restraint.
Which is an example, then, of what happens. Again, the Park Service can make all kinds of plans, but then political pressures and even public moods will change, and they're going back to the drawing board and coming up with new plans.
Well, the national park system subsists on our national political system, and I guess it always will. It's always going to be subject to the dictates or the whims or the good offices of the way we are thinking about those spaces. As you may frequently hear, however, it's not just that those whims arrive from some magical place or people kind of scratch their heads and change their minds. How we think about public lands and national forests and all the rest of it is influenced heavily by who's spending money and whose interests are being served by that money. That influences public opinion powerfully. But even when public opinion isn't at play, those are the people and those are the corporate interests who can manipulate our political system in their favor. National parks are not a partisan issue. Everybody loves them. Every survey that's taken, when it's, shall we get more resources out of national parks or shall we protect them? Shall we get more jobs by exploiting national parks or shall we make sure that they're protected? The answer is always from nearly everybody, save the national parks. But what's going on behind the scenes, especially in light of climate change and with all public lands, is people with far-ranging and very expensive interests in certain kinds of decision-making about using those public lands, they have ways of getting their way, and they've been extremely successful in doing it.
Stephen Nash, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a longtime reporter on science and the environment. His work has appeared in the Washington Post and other publications. He's written two previous books. We are talking about his 2017 book, Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Let's get your thoughts in here about public lands and their appropriate uses and who should dictate that and through what process. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I gather from the book, Stephen, you fretted a bit about naming this Grand Canyon for sale. Why?
I just wanted people to understand what's at stake. I think you mentioned at the top of the program that that the title is not to be taken literally, or at least not quite literally. That's a fair comment. What I wanted to do, though, was get people to examine the very near future of places like Grand Canyon and what is going to happen to the living things, which are part of our national promise. Grand Canyon's always going to be there. The beautiful calendar shots, the cathedral of rock, that's always going to be there, and it's very likely that nobody will penetrate those boundaries and stick a hotel or a power shovel or a mining operation inside Grand Canyon. But the national promise isn't just to preserve the rocks. It's to preserve the living systems within places like that. Grand Canyon is extremely rich. It's arid throughout a lot of it, but its biological diversity is really astonishing. We've already lost a lot of that. That's the future that is for sale in the sense that private interests are dictating the future of that natural life.
You make it clear how many nooks and crannies the Grand Canyon has, and then of course with all the changes in elevations, all kinds of ecosystems in there. You just said it's not in great shape, but and there's an example about things going on naturally in there, which humans have perverted a bit. Cheatgrass, an invasive species, how has that changed the ecosystem in that park?
Cheatgrass is something that's probably familiar to a lot of your listeners if they have anything to do with managing open lands of their own, grazing lands or any other lands. It's an import. It arrived here, as far as anybody knows, in the 1800s, probably thought of as, it could have been a stowaway that was introduced inadvertently, or somebody thought it was good forage or good ground cover, something like that. But cheatgrass, like other invasive species, doesn't have any natural predators. Nothing has evolved to keep it under control on the North American continent. And it behaves differently than our other native grasses, and it has a competitive advantage because of the lack of predators and some other competitive advantages, too. So it kind of takes over what's amounted to millions of acres of federal public lands and private lands and everywhere else. It burns frequently, and it burns in a way that clears out other native species. It is also...
So it's also the fire ecosystem, you point out.
Yes, exactly. And it's also not as good as sustaining native wildlife. They don't eat it or they don't like it. And a lot of what they do like begins to disappear under the pressure of cheatgrass. That's just one of a very long list of invasives that show up widely, even in what look like remote, pristine areas like Grand Canyon National Park.
And you point out that by some figures, invasives spread 7 square miles a day on public land. That's all public land across the country. And there are lots of efforts to fight them, pull them out. Some of these things, you describe one plant where the thorns will actually go through leather gloves, but that's on the ground. There are other efforts you point out that could help trying to keep invasives out of the country in the first place, like through ports. How good or not are those efforts?
Well, prevention is the best medicine. And in countries like Australia and New Zealand, they have learned, as we have not, that a really rigorous inspection of everything coming into the country slows down trade a little bit. And a rigorous inspection procedure costs a little more money on the basis of how big our trade is. It would be a tiny amount of money amortized over a huge amount of incoming cargo. But when you take those protective steps, when you're careful about what new organisms are being introduced on the landscape, you slow down having to deal with invasives that are new invasives that are always pressing to come in. Because of travel and trade, we've built, in a sense, bridges to all of the other continents on the planet. And these other plants and animals are crossing as fast as they can. And at that point, this begins to sound like it's related to our really toxic national debate over human immigration, but it really isn't. Invasive species of other kinds are a whole different ballgame and a different conversation. After all, we humans are all one species, and we're not invasive. We're we're all over the place.
We have a question here from Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Nash, the author of Grand Canyon for Sale. Hi, Anne.
Thank you. So at the age of 76, I can remember when there were environmentalist politicians in the Republican Party like Tom McCall. And since you've lived in Oregon, I'm sure you're familiar with Tom McCall. Anyway,
oh, yeah.
There are no longer, that I can find, any environmental politicians in the Republican Party. And my question is, in your opinion, how did the Republican Party become so corrupt? Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that.
I'm going to be a little disagreeable, Anne, and say that I think both parties are corrupt in this sense. The problems that I'm reciting didn't start with the Trump administration, and so they've been with us for a very long time. The question about what happened to the staunch conservationists who used to be also conservatives within the Republican Party, I'm a little out of my league. I don't know enough about that history quite to say. It seems to me, and maybe it does to you too, that attaches to a sort of a general polarization across our whole political landscape that maybe started with the election of Ronald Reagan when conservatives who could safely and proudly call themselves conservationists began to disappear from the landscape. But if I had to find a villain, and it wouldn't be a personal villain, it would be a systemic villain, it would be the increasing influence of money on our political landscape. It's always been there. That's nothing new. But now it is so pervasive and so powerful that it has sort of dictated that polarization.
You know,
not a very good answer, but a really good question.
All right. Thanks for that, Anne and Eugene. And then I want to add to this a comment from Becca, also in Lane County. She says, I was so excited about the latest public lands bill passing, and it had more than 360 yes votes in the House. It was 92-8 in the Senate. She says, I know many conservatives love the wildlands as much as we ecos do, so that adds to the discussion about politics there. I want to ask, I want to turn the attention now to the climate part of what's going on in the parks and maybe a little more focused on that. Because we've talked about things like, creatures that migrate northward or up in elevation to try to find new zones, places that feel more like the place they're used to living. But as you point out, when you're talking about things like trees, particularly the trees of Grand Canyon National Park, these are not things that move easily. Why?
That's true not only in Grand Canyon. It's true on a species-by-species basis through all of our forests, including the ones in Oregon. So some species can disperse their pollen and seeds a little more quickly than others. There's a lot of mechanics involved in this very interesting field of science. A lot of trying to figure out, this is a branch of botany called archaeobotany, a lot of trying to figure out these days how species began to recede under the pressure of the ice age, and then when the planet began to warm and the ice caps retreated, how things like trees began to repopulate landscapes and indeed, at least at a species level, began to move back toward the north as things warmed up.
All right, we'll have to pause there for just a second. Stephen Nash, our guest, the book Grand Canyon for Sale, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Stephen Nash, a longtime reporter on science and the environment. He's written a couple of books and now a third one, Grand Canyon for Sale. It is not literal. It is subtitled Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. He looks at public lands generally with a particular focus on Grand Canyon as one of the most recognizable bits of public land in the country. Stephen's more or less making a homecoming. He did spend some time growing up in Josephine County. We are talking about public lands very generally. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And let me give you a chance to finish the thought. Then you were talking about the migration of animals and plants and studies into things like how trees repopulate the landscape after an ice age, for example.
Yes, and through the study of fossilized pollen and through lots of other means, we have a beautiful telescope that takes us back in time and allows us to examine the processes by which these things repopulate landscapes where it was either too cold or too warm or something. In a previous epoch. And of course, that's a pressing question now because we want to know if these species can move. And it's an open question. The science is very young in that regard. I'm making the case everywhere I can about consolidating public lands so that this migration, this response to climate change can happen. But lurking behind that optimism, is really that very pressing question. Climate change is advancing so fast that a lot of these species may not be able to move. And in that case, and this is heresy in some quarters, I'm not advocating and I'm just pointing out that some scientists are asking, aren't we humans going to have to get involved in what's called enhanced migration? Aren't we going to physically have to intercede and take some of these species and move them north physically and replant them or repopulate them on the landscapes and keep helping the adaptation in that way? It's unfathomably complex, but it may be something we have to consider.
Yeah, as you point out, the idea of enhanced or assisted migration is a debate, not a plan at this point. So we're talking about potentially helping things along. Now, one of the things that we talked about earlier, although perhaps not by that term, was the idea of corridors. Now, you're talking about consolidating public lands so that it doesn't have particular boundaries, or what do you mean when you talk about trying to consolidate public land?
Public lands are administered in three or four different agencies, mainly. The Park Service has its fiefdom, and Bureau of Land Management, as Oregonians know, has a lot of rangeland and grassland and desert lands, very arid kinds of places under its purview. And then there's the National Forests, which are part of the Department of Agriculture. Each of them have their own kind of cultural history and their own levels of protection for these landscapes. There may be a place where some uses, even mining, even drilling for gas and oil can be safely accommodated. The problem now is that we have no sense of the priorities. We've been pretending for generations that we can have it all. We can preserve the ecosystem, and then we can put in pump jacks and drill rigs and herds of cattle. That's plainly not true. The ecosystems suffer and sometimes perish under that kind of industrial pressure. What I'm advocating is that we consolidate public lands administratively, or certainly in terms of what is prioritized. Natural systems come first. Anything else that we can accommodate that doesn't threaten the function of those natural systems, that might be okay. The way things are now, though, the industry comes first, the privatization of those resources comes first, and we sort of whistle past the graveyard in terms of what happens to natural systems instead. To talk about corridors, and please intervene if I'm getting too windy here.
No, that's fine.
The problem is those are short-term or those are longer-term kinds of plans, and they need to be explored. We need to be ready when the opportunity arises. In the short term, this administration just decided by executive order in December to boost logging on public lands by 30%. Oil and gas drilling have tripled in the last 2 years. It's been called what's happened to our national monuments. 10 of them on the list of national monuments, big ones, but especially a handful in Utah, they've been scaled back in what has been called the largest rollback of protection for federal lands in the nation's history.
Yeah, the Cascade
Siskiyou,
in our part of Oregon, is
involved. So we have this short-term political brush fire to deal with.
Let me take a call here. We have, Francis in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Nash, the author of Grand Canyon for Sale. Francis, are you there? No, Francis. Okay. Well, let's come back to a different question here. One of the things about the resource use of federal lands is the proximity thing, Stephen. It seems like the closer you are to the land, the more you want to have that resource land used. So, in a sense, do people who live closer to national forests, BLM land, kind of have veto power over the wishes of the rest of the country?
It's natural for us to sympathize with people who live on the landscape in a way that we want to concede to them more say-so over the landscape. And I can see that operating in some cases in a very healthy way. It doesn't, however, mean that the uses that the landscape is put to can compromise their health. Of course, we want to let local people make some decisions about how to maintain that health. What we can't do is say, and it, by the way, it isn't usually local people, it's usually outsiders who come in forcefully and dictate these things. What we don't want to say is, sure, you're local, do anything you want to. But yeah, people have a proprietary interest in the forests and the rangelands in their own backyards. That's perfectly understandable.
We got another phone call from Phil in Eureka who didn't stay on the line. He just wanted to know what that invasive grass was we were talking about. It's cheat grass, C-H-E-A-T grass was what we were talking about before. I wanted to ask about the water supplies in the Grand Canyon and a portion of the book that you devote to a threat from development nearby.
Grand Canyon is as anybody can see, even just looking at a photograph, most of it is a very dry place with a beautiful, big, cold river at the bottom. That puts a premium on the water inside the canyon in tiny seeps and springs. There are a few hundred of those, and they're very small. If you've ever hiked or backpacked in the Grand Canyon, you know how important those sources of water can be for your own maintenance. But they're also important to the many species that live within the canyon. 80% or more of the natural life in the canyon depends on those little sources of groundwater because it doesn't rain very reliably there. When it does, it's more of a flood than a steady supply of water. So it's groundwater that's so meaningful. In the canyon, I've been talking a lot about natural systems and so forth. In Grand Canyon, there's 2,000 species of plants, 91 kinds of mammals, 57 reptiles and amphibians, and hundreds of birds and thousands of insects, and 17 different native fish. most of those animals and plants depend on that groundwater. Well, up on the canyon rim, there's a proposal for a commercial development, commercial and residential. If the commercial space is allowed to be developed, it would be the equivalent of the third largest shopping mall in America. It's like bringing Phoenix or Las Vegas within a mile or two of the boundaries of Grand Canyon National Park. That's an aesthetic problem. It's disagreeable for many people who think differently about national parks. It's an overcrowding problem. Grand Canyon is already desperately overcrowded in many seasons, and bringing more hundreds of thousands of people is probably not a good idea. But what's vital is that the water for that kind of development has to come from someplace. And one likely source, this hasn't been decided yet, but it's certainly a threat, and the developer has said it's his right to do this if he wants to. It's an Italian corporation that owns these private parcels. They want to stick their soda straw, perhaps, into groundwater supplies. And those may, nobody knows for sure, they may be the same supplies that feed those little tiny seeps and springs within Grand Canyon. We don't have good legislative processes for dealing with those kinds of threats. That proposal is somewhat off the table for now, but as we know, the President of the United States has an affinity for real estate development, and it may be that it is still under consideration. Certainly the ownership is still there, and certainly those people would like to reap what they think of as the benefits of it.
So when it comes to dollars with public lands, and it can be a rather abstract concept at times, but it appears that we're really good at calculating the value of things we can take from the land and utilize someplace else through sale of, you know, whatever the hydrocarbon might be or the timber off the land, that sort of thing. We focus on things like dollar damages when those things are damaged, when trees blow down, et cetera. But it sounds like we never really calculate the impacts on things like loss of species or loss of ecosystems. Is that about right?
That is about right. There's a whole school of thought in economics for the past couple of decades that tries to do that kind of counting house mentality for ecosystem services and for the value of species. One way to do it is to ask the general public, what would you pay to clear up the air in Grand Canyon, or what would you pay to maintain the health of the national herd of bighorn sheep? It's not a very well-informed way to make policy, but I guess it's better than nothing. I think what we have brought to the conversation in the past, and it's still there, it just needs to come forward again, is the kind of humility that says, look, we have no idea how to calculate the worth of a species of some kind, or an ecosystem of some kind, or a natural landscape. We don't need to try to reduce this to arithmetic or dollars. We just need to protect it. We need to protect it so that some future generation can make up its mind all over again what's the best use for this landscape. It's a sense of self-limitation. I think of it as humility, and I think it's the kind of thing that brought us the national parks. They didn't arrive here out of some kind of automatic process. People had to fight for them, and the national forests also, and the monuments and all the rest of it, and we're having to fight for them again.
So, Stephen, I mean, you obviously talked to a lot of people and took in a lot of information. I mean, what is your level of optimism or lack thereof about whether we'll make a course change or basically continue along the usual path where we make plans and then disasters happen or something goes wrong or administrations change and everything gets blown off course and a new plan has to emerge?
Perfectly natural, especially when we're confronted with the specter of climate change, to feel rather gloomy. In the short term and in the medium term, I'm familiar with the feeling too. It really matters, though, to keep up our hopes. My favorite ecologist, David Orr, says that hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. We really have to keep that hope going. And you know, there are a lot of good, strong, hopeful phenomena on the horizon. just in the last few weeks, a new poll that says that the American public has come around to wanting to have the climate change conversation in a very serious way. 70% of people, Republicans and Democrats, 70% of the American public says they take global warming seriously. That's a big shift just in the last couple of years, and it's a very good thing. National parks, they're bipartisan. Support for that is enormous. And finally, the land itself, that beautiful portfolio, that million square miles of federal public lands that belongs to all of us, that legacy, there's a lot of hope in that. It's still there. It just needs our protection.
What do you think just folks should be doing to get the word across, to follow the path you're talking about?
You know, in the last chapter, I said plainly that I ducked that question, and let me explain why. It wouldn't be feasible for me to bring a prescription for what your listeners should do about this. They all have their own resources and their own creativity and their own levels of energy. You can go online and in a split second find 50 different organizations about public lands, about climate change, about Oregon's national forests, and join that public conversation and that fight.
Much to be done. The book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Lands versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. It's the work of Stephen Nash. Thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for the opportunity.